Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back, everyone, to New Books in Military History. This is your host, Bob Wintermute. Today, I'm pleased to welcome back to New Books Greg Daddis. I don't know if any of you recall, but 6 years ago, Greg joined us to discuss his book, No Sure Victory, Measuring U.S. Army Effectiveness and Progress in the Vietnam War. Now, since then, Greg's career has certainly undergone quite a transition. He retired from the United States Army with the rank of colonel and is currently an associate professor at Chapman University, where he's also the director of their MA program in War and Society. Most recently, he served as a project advisor on Ken Burns' much-discussed series, The Vietnam War. But today, we're going to be talking with Greg about his two most recent books, not just one, but two, which taken together, I feel, offer a very comprehensive revisionist account of the Vietnam War. The first is Westmoreland's War, Reassessing American Strategy in Vietnam. And the second is Withdrawal, Reassessing America's Final Years in Vietnam. Both of these being published by Oxford University Press. And by way of full disclosure, I'll offer, as I did in our first interview, that Greg and I share an intellectual pedigree and that we both took courses early on at Temple University under the late Russell Weigley. Greg, thanks for coming back.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bob. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Good to have you.
Yeah.
Listen, I've asked you this question about No Sure Victory, but I do think it certainly has some relevance in this context as well.
Mm-hmm.
Basic question. What prompted you to pursue the project? And was it always your intention to write a multi-volume history of the military strategy and management of the Vietnam War?
Yeah. No, it certainly wasn't my intention. I obviously bit off a lot more than I initially was planning on chewing on. So No Sure Victory really came from a request for information just as the Iraq War was ramping up in 2003 and 2004 when I was serving at West Point. And a senior commander in the Special Forces that was on his heading to his second tour in Iraq basically asked the History Department if they had any information on how you measured progress and effectiveness in an unconventional environment. That if you didn't have the standard ways to track progress like geography or if there was a war without fronts, as Thomas Thayer called it back in the mid-80s, that how did you get a sense of whether you were making progress or not, or whether your operations were being effective? And so a colleague of mine and I dove into a case study on Vietnam, and he worked on the French Indochina aspect of it, and I did the American experience. And what I quickly found is that much of the literature was actually inaccurate, that the larger storyline of the American experience in Vietnam was that there was this attrition strategy, and the measure the metric of measurement was the body count. And that was it, that the U.S. Army was committed to one thing and one thing only, which was killing the enemy. The best way to measure progress, obviously, was the body count, and that was it. And as I started doing more and more research, I found that just the opposite was the case, that there was this incredible effort to measure just about everything from the military side of the house, the political, the development, the economy. And so that's where No Sure Victory came from. And then the logical question was that if something had to be wrong in the literature, that if the United States Army was measuring all of these other things besides body count, was it possible that the strategy was more than just about attrition? And that was really the question that I asked coming out of North Shore Victory that led to a reassessment of Westmoreland's strategy.
Well, let's turn to Westmoreland's War. You describe how you take issue as a scholar with the way that past and present historians have really positioned William Westmoreland as just settling on an attritional strategy
right
in Vietnam. And you go on to argue that on the whole, we've misunderstood Westmoreland and the skills he brought to bear mm-hmm. in the Vietnam How so?
In one sense, I think he's become this one-dimensional caricature, this kind of modern major general that is completely out of his depth, that the scholars like Andrew Kapanovich's The Army in Vietnam kind of paints Westmoreland and a larger army as committed to this army concept where all they know is World War II style of fighting. And they don't have the intellectual capacity to kind of move beyond a World War II style of fighting. And what I was hoping to accomplish with Westmoreland's War was to add some depth to the character, to kind of pull him out of the historical oversimplification, I think, and kind of put him directly back into his time. And I think when you do that, you see an officer and a larger military command in Vietnam that is much more attuned to the complexities of the war that they're encountering. They, I think, clearly understand that this is just as much a political war as it is a military war, and are, in fact, I think, cognizant that military operations alone are not going to solve some of the underlying problems that they're facing in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Well, you go on to argue that a big part of the problem we have with understanding Vietnam as a whole is that, as a rule, the definition of strategy mm-hmm. as applied to military operations is murky. How has that become an issue here?
I think we're still dealing with that issue today, to be quite frank. And just trying to get a sense of what we mean by strategy. And there's so many definitions out there. I touched upon a few of them at the beginning of Westmoreland's War, just to kind of get a sense of the problem of coming up with a strategy and defining it. And if we think about what strategy means, you can go back to Clausewitz, obviously, and think about this as being something that's, in his term, the use of the engagement for the purpose of war. And then if you look at critics like B.H. Liddell Hart, who in World War I said that, this definition posed by Clausewitz was really a way to glorify battle, and that strategy had to be much more comprehensive and hopefully place you in a position where you can achieve a better state of future peace, as he called it. Or if you look at Colin Gray's more recent definition, where it's this bridge between military power and political purpose. And so I think that complicates the narrative, is that there's so many different definitions out there. And then when you actually look at the definition that the U.S. Army was using on the cusp of that organization going to Vietnam, it too is immensely complex and overarching, even to the point, I think, of being vague, that it characterizes strategy as political and economic and psychological. And what I found, in fact, is that rather than just being a simple strategy of attrition, of just focus on killing the enemy, Westmoreland, in fact, was very much in line with this contemporary definition of strategy, which I think was, in a sense, replicating what Liddell Hart was saying in terms of strategy needing to be comprehensive to hopefully achieve that better state of peace.
Right. Well, this is all taking place against the backdrop of decolonization and the wars of national liberation.
Exactly.
Which themselves have a different context.
That's an incredibly important point, Bob. And I think my sense is, again, that senior officers, not just Westmoreland, but others in the Army, understood that. They understood that there were these new forces that were being unleashed, not just in Indochina, but obviously in North Africa and Algeria. And we saw the British dealing with issues of decolonization in Malaya. So I think there is a sense among the officer corps at that time that this is very different than World War II, and the decolonization and issues of independence and thinking about how these societies are going to define themselves in the modern era, in the post-colonial era, is also part of the larger problem that they're confronting.
So in essence, then, Westmoreland was prepared. He had the background, both professionally and intellectually, to respond to these pressures. Does he have a plan not only to end the war, but to actually win in Vietnam?
That's another great question. I think the problem that not just Westmoreland deals with, but Abrams, his successor, I think the same problem that Johnson and Nixon deal with is, what's the definition of victory? And obviously, it is very different than World War II, where the president gives Eisenhower, as an example, in Europe, an objective of unconditional surrender of the enemy. And that clearly is not going to be the case here. So from the very beginning, there is a sense that because of the political limitations placed on U.S. armed forces, that the outright defeat of North Vietnam in a traditional military sense is not going to be accomplished here. So in one sense, it's probably more of a that Korea has more of historical relevancy here in terms of defining what victory means. And again, that seems to be something that will have to be negotiated. And I think that's the problem that that Westmoreland deals with early on. I think from the start, he is certainly there to arrest and then hopefully reverse what he calls the losing trend, and then place the allies in a position where South Vietnam will be able to become a stable and independent non-communist government, which was the objective. And I think clearly that's a daunting political objective, and I think one that plays at the very heart of why ultimately Westmoreland is not as successful as he might have hoped to be.
Right. Well, I'm struck as I read both books by the extent to which that Westmoreland, Abrams, and generally the staff at MACV had really inculcated Maoist theory of revolutionary war. And you could see how, as you describe, in many circumstances, Westmoreland and others are looking at the conflict as, we're entering that third right. stage in the Maoist insurrection model.
Yeah, and the problem with that is that Lê Duẩn and the Politburo is not strictly following a Maoist model. And so, in one sense, this is, I think, where Westmoreland can be taken up for a bit of criticism, is I think that the MACV staff, along with Westmoreland, is very much thinking in a sequential model of strategy, in large part because that's how Mao's model lays out. And so every time that they see the North Vietnamese army participating in large-scale campaigns and battles, that seems to be proof to them that the Hanoi's leaders have made that transition over to the third phase of Maoist revolutionary doctrine. But I think the Politburo and Lê Duẩn in particular was much more flexible in its application of Maoist doctrine than probably most officers at the time believed.
Yes, certainly. Certainly. And again, it's that example of, preparing to wage the next conflict on the basis of what are perceived lessons for the prior.
Exactly.
One.
And I think we're still struggling with this today in our own doctrine when it comes to counterinsurgency. I think we still very much take a sequential approach. And if you think about, if you compare doctrine today under, the revamping of counterinsurgency doctrine under Petraeus, and compare that to the early and mid 60s counterinsurgency doctrine, they both mirror a process that is sequential in nature, where security comes first and then political stability will follow. And that stability will lead to political success against the insurgency. And the problem, I think, that Westmoreland and Abrams both have in Vietnam is it's never that sequential, that it's always intertwined, that the political stability or instability in Saigon is always impinging on the security campaign. And the security campaign, because it's necessarily violent, even the misnomered pacification campaign is not as peaceful as we would have liked to, or as officers hoped it would have been, that security campaign is undermining the stability aspect of the political community. And so I think that's really what officers at the time never were quite able to grapple with to the ground is how do you do security and development and political stability operations simultaneously, so they're not competing with one another. And I think, quite frankly, we're still struggling with that today.
You raised a second question early on in the book, too, about the overall strategy that was developed. by McAfee and how it was mm-hmm. introduced. And the question in particular is, were the material means employed in Vietnam consistent with the plan and its ultimate objectives? How do we respond to that?
Westmoreland certainly would have suggested that the means were not within line for the objectives that were given to him.
Well, we see that in the constant request for further escalation. Right. Sure. But does that then, I mean, we're talking also about, again, as we've described, this difference between conventional mm-hmm. war and a counterinsurgency, and the means that are brought to bear for the conventional war are certainly going to be counterproductive, right. as we've described amongst general population.
Yeah, and so if you think about his strategy as he developed it as this kind of three-phase operation, which was going to take years in his mind. That this first task alone, the first phase to, as I mentioned, halt the losing trend, included securing major military bases and defending major political and population centers. It was also included, obviously, fighting the enemy and strengthening the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. And then as we moved into the second phase of his strategy, he hoped to resume the offensive and destroy the enemy forces, but also reinstate or reinstitute what he called rural pacification or rural construction activities, which ultimately came under the larger rubric of pacification. And so when you put all this together in terms of, you know, securing bases and population centers and training and strengthening the local army and defeating the enemy on the field of battle and participating in pacification and development activities, and then ultimately in the third phase, hoping to defeat and destroy the enemy, and then ultimately turn it over to the South Vietnamese. That's a lot of resources, and it's important to note here that they're not just military resources. There's a large, obviously, civilian effort that's part of the pacification campaign that will take hold in late 1966 and really get underway in 1967. So. That is a problem, I think, and McNamara actually acknowledges this in his memoirs after the war. That you know, he said he acknowledges that he wished they would have had more of a discussion about more than just resources that were going to be put into the effort, but how those resources likely would have been able to accomplish the objectives set out for the military command. And so, what I think you have happen is that. Early on in that spring of 1965, as the president, Lyndon Johnson, is getting ready to make the decision to send full ground combat troops to South Vietnam, there's a discussion about resources, but there's never a discussion about how those resources are going to be used in the most effective way to accomplish this larger political goal of a stable and independent non-communist South Vietnam. And that clearly is a major gap in the strategic planning process of the early American effort.
Well, it's interesting too, I think. I mean, when I teach Vietnam in my graduate mm-hmm. courses, we just covered it briefly in a foreign policy course last semester. You know, I try to make the case, or I encourage students to consider Vietnam not merely as the military contest, really exclusively as a political right. contest, but looking it through the lens and the framework of modernization exactly. theory. And this idea that we're going to save South Vietnam by remaking it mm-hmm. in our image as much as possible. But if you don't have the resources to do that or understand what those resources need to be, it becomes a almost insurmountable task.
Right. And I think when you focus too much on the resources, especially the military resources, you're not challenging the assumptions upon which modernization theory is built. That it may very well be likely that local leaders do not see the United States as the apogee of political thought, that there may in fact have been a genuine commitment to communist theory, not just in North Vietnam, but in South Vietnam as well. And I think there wasn't enough discussion about that in terms of whether those, in a sense, almost New Deal reforms that were implanted into foreign policy thought were valid as we moved into the 1950s and into the 1960s.
And yet, even at the beginning of the direct intervention in the spring of 1965, you have many prominent members in the Johnson administration looking at South Vietnam as a lost cause, you know, at least in the absence of a stable government or a popular government. This creates an even taller order for Westmoreland.
I think so. There's, you know, you do have the key dissenter inside the Johnson White House is Under Secretary of State George Ball, but really doesn't kind of get as much traction as he would have liked in terms of having the president reconsider some of his decisions when it comes to, as Ball called it, getting on the tiger's back and then not being able to know when you're going to get off. But yeah, I think that does complicate matters for Westmoreland because ultimately, at least my research concludes that it's really up to Westmoreland to come up with a strategy for Vietnam. And that's problematic because he doesn't really command the air campaign over North Vietnam.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. That's a critical point.
Unlike his predecessors, I think he's clearly dealing with a much more complex problem than just kind of fighting conventionally in Europe against the German army is just one example. And so the problem I think Westmoreland has is because there's not enough dialogue between the White House and MACV headquarters in these early stages, that he's really left to develop strategy on his own. And I think he probably would have been better served. I think the White House would have been better served if they had had more intense debates about that strategy as it was unfolding. Again, and most importantly, in terms of whether the military tool was capable of accomplishing the political objective.
Well, let's move towards the plan for waging war and safeguarding the civilian population in South Vietnam. Did William Westmoreland actively pursue an attrition strategy?
Yes, partly. So I think the challenge here is to acknowledge that he clearly was waging a war against the enemy that was both conventional and unconventional. He obviously was hopeful that as part of this process of defeating the enemy, that he was going to have to attrit and destroy their capacity in the field. But he also spoke about attrition from a political standpoint as well, that this was a war of political attrition, not just in Vietnam, right, but also on the American home front, that very early on, he's writing to the Joint Chiefs of Staff about his concern that this political war of attrition will take a toll on the American home front and worry that he's going to lose support. And then also, that this attrition warfare inside South Vietnam is going to take a toll on the political community, not just in Saigon, but I think more importantly, among the rural population, which is a clear objective of Westmoreland's strategy to try and help build better relations between that rural population and the Saigon government and bring those two together. And again, as I mentioned earlier, that's part of the problem, I think, that with the American strategy in Vietnam is that it starts to work at cross purposes with each other.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, I appreciate your answer. I mean, I think it's a very nuanced position.
And I think it's, again, to relate this to more current day operations, it's hard to call this strategy something that is easily explainable to the American populace. How do you define our strategy in Iraq or Afghanistan? It's not simply a war of attrition. It's not just counterinsurgency. It's clearly not a war of annihilation. So what do we call it? And especially in wars like Vietnam or Afghanistan, which are very much provincial in nature, that the war is not only complicated but complex, meaning that the war in the northern provinces is a very different war that's being fought in the Mekong Delta, in large part because of the enemy situation and geography and political loyalties. And so that makes it even more difficult, I think, for Westmoreland because he has to articulate these broad military concepts in an incredibly complex environment and do so in a way that makes sense to the American public and I would argue to the Vietnamese population as well. And I'm not so sure he had the language to do just that. And so I think what happens is, because the military lexicon of the day is unsuited to characterize this, we end up with these cliches of body count, search and destroy, attrition, because it just is easier for us to put a word on it. The war in Iraq.
And the sad thing is so many historians have just jumped upon that without trying to parse the issues of right. language and discourse.
And I think you're seeing it today as well, right? That how do we define our strategy in Iraq? And more often than not, we come up to the term surge, and that clearly simplifies and probably is not accurate at all in terms of defining an overall comprehensive strategy.
Absolutely not. Well, let's talk about operations then. I mean, you do go into some detail about that. And you describe, I want to start a little bit later and then we'll work back. You describe by 1966, 1967, that the operations have come to resemble what you call, I like this phrasing, a mosaic war, in which you have different divisional and corps commanders being left free, really, to devise their own tactical responses and even administrative responses in their areas of operation. Doesn't this undermine Westmoreland's efforts for an overall success in Vietnam?
Partly, I think, in the sense that there are some commanders that are obviously more heavy-handed than others. There are,
right. You mentioned 4th Division.
Although they're dealing with a very different war on the borderlands of South Vietnam, so they're worried about infiltration into South Vietnam, especially against North Vietnamese regulars. There are some commanders that don't believe that pacification is the key to victory, that it is, in fact, destruction of the enemy main force units that will set the stage for success. There are some commanders that don't get along well with their Vietnamese counterparts, which is a critical aspect of the war that often gets left out of the storyline. And yet, I think Westmoreland has to allow some flexibility in the implementation of his strategy because of that mosaic nature, that he can't prescribe a comprehensive strategy because or he can't prescribe the best operational approaches and tactics to support that comprehensive strategy because the war is so different. If you think of the war in the southern portion of South Vietnam in the Mekong Delta, the enemy is much more of an insurgency than what the Marines are dealing with in I Corps in the northern provinces. And so Westmoreland has to leave that up to the local commanders to figure out how best to deal with their specific problems. And Abrams will do the same exact thing under his tenure as well.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You raise I Corps and the Marine Corps. I mean, that raises the other issue, which I've been at conferences, Society of Military History conferences over the last few years, and there's been a big revival in scholarship on the combined action programs that the Marines instituted in I Corps, presented as a future model for counterinsurgency and such. How does Westmoreland respond to that?
I think correctly in the fact that it's overblown, this promise that the combined action programs poses never really matches reality. And I've actually done some research on this. And even the Marines themselves in the official history of the Corps' participation in Vietnam suggests that the CAPs never really kind of evolved as much as was hoped. So the other part of this clearly is that there's a suggestion that the Marines had it right, and the Marine commanders in the northern provinces were aghast at this strategy of attrition and wanted to follow a much more counterinsurgency approach. But again, that just is not it doesn't quite bear out, especially when you take a look at the percentages forces put into the CAP program vice, those that were left to conventional operations. And again, we have to keep in mind that those five northernmost provinces in South Vietnam were along the DMZ and along the borderlands with Laos. So it was much more of a conventional war, as you saw with the assault and siege on Khe Sanh as just one example, or the borderland battles in 1967. The numbers, if I'm not mistaken, I think at no point during the war did the Marine Corps place more than 5%, and I think it's actually less than that, of their resources into the Combined Action Program. And at no point were any of the Combined Action Programs capable of kind of leaving behind a sustainable local presence. And so my sense is that that's kind of part of the myth of this failed strategy in Vietnam is that Westmoreland clearly saw or was presented with a better opportunity and ignored that opportunity. And I just don't see that as being validated by the source material.
Sure. Well, as you pointed out earlier, you know, the air war certainly complicates matters as well. You know, I mean, he has certainly, you know, full stand-on support for tactical air, but it's the strategic bombing aspect and even the regional bombing aspect along the border.
It is, and it's an issue for Westmoreland. It's very much an issue during the 1972 campaign between Abrams and Nixon. Abrams actually, for the second time during his tenure in McVie, is almost relieved of command, in this case over the air campaign. And so it does complicate it, I think, in terms of placing this strategy within the larger context of the American approach to Southeast Asia, that that Operation Rolling Thunder was planned on other certain assumptions that were never quite realized. And you know, the hope that a bombing campaign would undermine the will of Hanoi never quite worked itself out. The hope that the air campaign against the Ho Chi Minh Trail would stop the infiltration to South Vietnam never quite worked itself out. I think that's clearly part of the other aspect of this that you have to take into account to think about why American strategy wasn't as successful as it might have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, we come to Tet, and the general consensus, obviously, is that it had very minimal, reluctant to say this, but to a degree, minimal lingering impact on the military aspect of the conflict, you know, the direct operations, American operations, but that rather it was a largely strategic success affecting American public opinion at this crucial moment. And I don't want to disregard that. I mean, I think that there's a certainly ample evidence that that's the case, but I've always thought that this is rather singularly focused on an American-centric narrative. How does Tet contribute to the breakdown of Westmoreland's multi-tiered strategy and its his relations with the government in the Republic of Vietnam?
I think you're right. We've come to believe the myth of Tet that it is this great turning point, that in a war without very many turning points, that this is the one turning point of the war where the North Vietnamese don't succeed militarily, but somehow miraculously pull out a political victory because of the way that this offensive impacted the American home front to include the media, and then obviously the president, who in March decides not to run for re-election. And I agree with you. I think that there are merits to kind of looking at that, but to me, what I find more fascinating is the assumptions that Tet are built upon from all sides, especially the Vietnamese side, that Lai Xuan very much is hoping for what he calls a decisive military victory. And I think this is important because there are those critics of Westmoreland who suggest that if only he had focused more on counterinsurgency, the Americans would have won in Vietnam. The problem with that critique is that Lai Xuan himself was actually seeking a decisive military victory, and Tet is an example of that. You see it again in 1972. So the problem with with that critique of Westmoreland is that he quite simply cannot ignore that conventional threat. And obviously doesn't. He also, I think, has some assumptions that are misplaced in late 1967 and early 1968. He welcomes the enemy's offensive along the borderlands, which draws the American forces out to the borderlands known as the border battles of 1967. He hopes that he can then take advantage of American firepower away from population centers. But that clearly doesn't set them up for success in the urban areas when Tet is unleashed in late January 1968. And I think there's also a set of assumptions based on Westmoreland participating in this salesmanship campaign run by the White House in 1967 that we are, in fact, making progress. And then all of a sudden, Tet happens. And I think that's why it is a traumatic event for many Americans at home. So, to me, it's an interesting tutorial in terms of thinking about strategy as necessarily based on certain assumptions. That if we go back to our discussion about resources and ends, that you have to make certain assumptions about those ends and objectives, and whether those objectives are within reach. And clearly, I think Tet is a fine example for any aspiring strategist to think about in terms of flawed assumptions.
Well, let's turn to Withdrawal, the second book. And you introduced the book with a very dramatic juxtaposition. You know, on the one hand, JFK's, President Kennedy's address to the 1962 graduating class at the United States Military Academy. And then Richard Nixon's same experience with the 1971 class. How does this inform for you our evolving understanding of Vietnam and the war?
To me, it's about, I think, a nation coming to grips with the limitations of its own power abroad. That if you listen to Kennedy's speech to the graduate or to the class at West Point, it is hopeful. It is inspiring as well as it is aspiring. And years later, when Nixon returns to the West Point, the first time that he visits there, the language and tone is so different. It's an uncomfortable realization that we have not succeeded in Vietnam, that the world is still dangerous, that that for the most part, our objectives have not been as accomplished, that the war is not advancing American interests, but in fact, weighing them down. And so to me, I think it's a nice way to think about this larger episode within with the American experience in the Cold War, of really the first time a generation of Cold Warriors coming to grips with the limits of American power. And I think that's a useful perspective to be gained from a study of Vietnam, is that there are, in fact, limits, and military power does not always achieve the political objective set out for it. And to have a discussion about why that's the case and why ultimately Nixon comes to that conclusion, I think is an important part of the story, especially as Westmoreland leaves and Abrams takes hold of MACV, because as you see Abrams take hold, there is another set of aspirations that follow him that I think are still part of the larger Abrams myth that we're dealing with today.
Well, we could confront the myth head on at the start. I mean, you describe, and I don't think it's just you, other historians point out, you know, with Abrams's appointment to the head of MACV in the summer of 1968, you know, this is going to be a new start. We're going to jumpstart a war that's been mired in stalemate. We're going to reintroduce new approaches to counterinsurgency and local operations. I've got to ask, in the first case, I mean, is that even a realistic assessment of the war's progress up to that point? And then the follow-up then, which we'll probably repeat later, was Abrams's leadership all that great of a difference or a change?
So first off, I don't think that there is much of a difference in terms of the military situation after Tet, that except for obviously the rise in casualties, if you just go back to the subtitle of Ron Spector's very good book, After Tet, it's the bloodiest year in Vietnam. But despite those increasing casualties, Abrams leaves 1968 the same way he entered 1968, which is facing a stalemated war. And so as much as Tet is touted as a turning point from a military perspective, the war is still very much stalemated in 1968. And clearly Abrams is dealing with that. And then also, obviously, after the election of Richard Nixon, is dealing with the political decision that that he is going to have to preside over a war that will not be won in a traditional sense.
Right. Well, I wanted to add to that. I mean, I don't disagree. It's stalemate as much as 68 after mm-hmm. Tet, particularly after March. I have to wonder how much of that is due to Johnson just basically abdicating responsibility. After he's, declared he will not be running, he's, right. I'm going to call him clearly a broken man at that point, with no further incentive or desire to.
Yeah, I think it. Right. In one sense, there is, there's a bit of replication in the summer of 1968, as there was in the summer of 1965, that the military commander in Saigon, the American military commander in Saigon, is left to his own devices in terms of coming up with a strategy to deal with the ongoing problems in Vietnam. So that, Johnson making the political decision not to run leaves Abrams in a sense in the same place that Westmoreland was in terms of crafting a strategy that that has not all that much input from the White House. And then to your second question, my research has found very little, if any, major changes to American strategy after Abrams takes over. And in one sense, I don't think we should be surprised by that. In fact, I have not found one program initiated under Abrams that was different than under William Westmoreland. Clearly, Abrams tried to think about the war, as he called it, a one-war approach, that this was all synchronized and weaved together. Although it was Ellsworth Bunker in May of 1967 who came up with that term, the ambassador to South Vietnam. So this idea that Abrams comes in with this brand new approach, I think, is wrongheaded, because Ambassador Bunker is talking in those terms, one war, before Abrams even arrives in Vietnam. And I think what you also see is still very much a sequential approach, that obviously Abrams is focusing more attention on training and equipping and hopefully modernizing the South Vietnamese army, because he knows that they're going to take more and more, they're going to have to shoulder more and more responsibility. He very much tries to take advantage of Tet and the destruction, though not outright defeat, of the National Liberation Front, known as the Viet Cong, and that the damage they took to their political structure, Abrams wants to take advantage of that and reemphasize pacification efforts. But he's still very much talking in terms of getting after the enemy, of striking crushing blows, of defeating him decisively. So I just don't get a sense that Abrams was any more imaginative than Westmoreland was when it came to approaching the war. And he clearly is dealing with a different set of political initiatives under Nixon, who's decided, even before he enters office, as he recalls in his memoir, that total military victory was no longer possible. So clearly Abrams is dealing with that. But from a strategic standpoint, I just haven't seen any evidence that there was much of a major change. And in fact, the new official history from the Center of Military History is coming out this week that covers the Tet period. And the main author of that book has found no major change in strategy as well.
Wouldn't be appropriate to talk about all this without raising mm-hmm. the counter arguments that a number of historians and writers have brought up about America's performance in Vietnam, starting from their criticism mm-hmm. of Vietnamization to pacification to their, their almost fanciful appreciation of the Phoenix program and such. You know, we start with Vietnamization. You know, there's those historians, Louis Sorley, you name it, there are others, Harry Summers and such, who insist that America's military performance in the field was the only factor that matters in determining victory. And that Vietnamization came too early. And, you know, had American forces been allowed to continue in the field, free of political interference, we could have somehow achieved a victory. I just can't see if there's ever really an alternative to de-escalation.
No, I don't think there is. And I'm troubled by the argument that suggests that if only military officers were given more political leeway, a different outcome. Because quite frankly, that's not what war is. War is a political act. And the suggestion that if only military professionals can be left alone in waging war, that takes the process of war itself out of its necessary context, which is a political act. And so I've never been all that found compelling this argument of a military victory and a political defeat, because it just tries to parse out military action from what war is.
Well, it also has, I think, this nefarious political context as well. It's like created a Dolchstoss or, you know, stab in the back myth about Vietnam that can be used for partisan purposes.
Yeah, and I think there's just and the other sense of this too, I think, is that too often gets left out is the Vietnamese piece of this. That I think at the end of the day, after and to me, this is the most exciting part of the field right now, is that more and more scholars are relying on Vietnamese sources and bringing the Vietnamese out from the shadows and putting them more center stage. Because I would argue at the end of the day that this war at its core is a competition and a struggle over Vietnamese national identity in the modern era, of asking the question, the fundamental question of what does it mean to be Vietnamese in the post-colonial era? And I'm just not so sure that William Westmoreland or Creighton Abrams could have answered that question. I don't think any outside military force, regardless of how brilliant the commander was, could have answered that question. That fundamentally was a Vietnamese question that had to be answered by Vietnamese themselves. And I think that's what ultimately is a portion of the story that too often gets left out of arguments by the likes of Harry Summers or Bob Sorley, that it just takes that fundamental question out of it. And if only we had stayed longer, if only we didn't, if only we had the political will, things would have turned out differently.
Right. It was a whole laundry list of items there. And again, we can go on about that at great length, but I want to focus some attention on My Lai and what it represents, not to the American public. There's been a lot of great brand analysis of this over the last few years as well. And I'm thinking too of Joseph Fry's book, The American South and the Vietnam War, which gives a counter narrative of how Americans viewed My Lai in the Southern United States. But how does the fact of the massacre and is being revealed, and then the subsequent investigation and trial affect MACV and affect the senior echelons and the staff there, not only in their management of an instrument that's very damaged, but also in relating to the representatives of the Vietnamese government?
I think it's part of a larger problem that MACV deals with throughout its tenure in South Vietnam, and that is how are military operations affecting the civilian population? And I think I'm not convinced that those like Nick Turse who argue and kill anything that moves, that that killing civilians was part and parcel of American command planning.
That's another really nefarious kind of trope.
Yeah, and I actually have been in those portions of the National Archives, the Vietnam Vietnam Crimes Working Group files, and I sympathize with authors like Turse because when you go through those files, it's emotionally draining and a very sad and ugly chapter of our American military history is brought out by spending time in those files. And clearly there were soldiers like Callie who failed in their moral obligations as officers and soldiers. And that clearly disrupted the larger objectives that the American command and the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese themselves were trying to accomplish, that as you mentioned, complicated the relationship between MACV and the Saigon leadership. But I also, in my studies, have found that that both Westmoreland and Abrams were very much committed to trying to limit as best as possible wanton destruction of the civilian population, that they understood that this was a contest over loyalty and political loyalty, and that when civilians were killed unnecessarily or murdered purposefully, that that was damaging their overall possibility of achieving their political objectives. But I also think it is an interesting, quite larger question here of what war does. I think, as you mentioned, there are clearly many, not just in the South, but many Americans who are sympathetic with Callie, that feel that he's scapegoated, that this isn't Callie, this is what war does to young American men. And many in the anti-war movement, as an example, will sympathize with Callie and use him as an example of what war does to good young American boys and why we need to leave Vietnam. Others inside the military command, I think, were less sympathetic. I think My Lai, in part, stems a professionalism study that's run by the Army War College in the late 60s and early 70s under Westmoreland's directive, that finds some disturbing trends in terms of professionalization and moral and ethical issues among the officer corps that have to be addressed because of this long war in Vietnam. And I think this is something that we'll probably continue to debate for years to come in terms of moral responsibilities about how war erodes combatants morally and ethically. What are our responsibilities to the civilian population in a war that is fought among the population themselves?
What are the responsibilities to our own soldiers who are placed in potentially compromising or even uncompromising positions? Yeah. Well, it's another constant in the meta narrative about Vietnam that's evolved over the last 50 years. You know, the idea that soldiers and Marines, at least by 1970, you know, are strung out on drugs and becoming largely ineffective in the field.
Not very.
How reliable is this?
I don't think at all. I think clearly, and Abrams very much is dealing with this in MACV headquarters, that after Tet in particular, I think you see many more draftees who are coming in that are not only more politically conscious than their predecessors, but are also more willing to experiment with drugs, to be more open-minded about that type of thing. But my sense is that that narrative is overblown, that for the most part, the larger American command and the soldiers in that command perform their duties just as competently as their predecessors did. I think the problem that occurs is one of not being able to reconcile the issues of fighting in a war that you know you're withdrawing from. And I think that complicates the willingness of soldiers to sacrifice and even potentially sacrifice their lives for a war that they know is not going to be won.
Yeah, I'm going to borrow directly, again, your own questions that you raise as you begin to summarize the end game in Vietnam for McVie. And that question is, at what point would American military and civilian leaders finally lose their leverage over the course of events inside South Vietnam? Now, some might argue this took place as early as 1965. You know, why raise it here at this point?
Well, I think it's a question that has to be asked in terms of Nixon's responsibilities to leaving the war. And he very much comes in, as I mentioned, knowing that total military victory, as he calls it, was no longer possible. And announces in late 1969 that the mission of the Americans in Vietnam is to basically hand over the war to the South Vietnamese, to give them full responsibility of state security to the South Vietnamese themselves. So I think the question then becomes is if how quickly should Nixon have left the war? You know, the argument is that we stayed on for four more years at a cost of thousands and thousands of more Americans and Vietnamese lives to accomplish not much. Whereas if we just ended the war as soon as Nixon took over, we would have saved an incredible amount of life and resources and ended up in the same place. Now, Nixon's retort to that, as well as Kissinger's, was that we had to withdraw from Vietnam as a matter of policy, not as collapse, that this was still part of a larger puzzle within the Cold War of trying to balance a renegotiation with the Russians and with the Chinese in terms of rethinking about larger Cold War relationships. And if we left Vietnam as a matter of collapse rather than policy, that was going to undermine Nixon's larger foreign policy aims.
It doesn't ring very, very strong or very true. I don't think, because you consider that as consider that as a purely Americentric or American exceptionalist view. Because, of course, who are the people who are really suffering?
Yeah, it's a Vietnamese,
in addition to American soldiers and casualties. When does Nixon give up on Abrams? And is that, you know, how, what does that say about Richard Nixon's own character, Rick?
Well, I think there's a frustration that is building with Abrams as early as 1970, there's not a lot of faith in Abrams as a military commander, and especially in Lamsung 719 in 1971, they feel that the White House feels that Abrams is misleading them in terms of evaluating the larger campaign. In March of 1971, actually considers relieving Abrams of command and sending Alexander Haig, who was then Kissinger's military deputy on the National Security Council staff, to Saigon. He cools off the next day and decides he's not going to relieve him. That happens again in the following year during the Easter Offensive in the spring of 1972, that there's this disagreement over air power, and Nixon again just goes into what he calls a cold rage, or what Haldeman is what Haig calls a cold rage. And I think what it says is not so much about Nixon himself and the relationship he has with Abrams, which is difficult at best. But I think what it says is something larger about Vietnam, in the sense of why is it that the commander in chief is frustrated with his military commander? And I think it is because, going back to how I think withdrawal and Westmoreland's were linked together, is the complexity of strategy, that Nixon's strategy is just as complex as anything under Johnson's era, that Nixon is trying to engage in Vietnamization, as you mentioned, which is handing over the South Vietnamese, the war, pacification. There's diplomatic isolation with North Vietnam. There's peace negotiations. There's the withdrawal of U.S. forces. That's a complicated problem for Abrams to figure out in terms of implementing that strategy. And when Abrams is incapable of doing that, to Nixon's satisfaction, I'm not sure any officer would have been able to do it to Nixon's satisfaction just because it was so complicated, that causes frustration in the White House. Now, I don't think Abrams does himself any favors. He's not. He's been sick. Man. And as I mentioned in the book, you know, I don't think this is a salacious footnote, but he's got a drinking problem. That drinking problem is made aware of in the White House. And, you know, so they see these kind of personal failings as professional failings as well that are interlocked. And I think that's why that contributes to this rocky relationship between the White House and McAfee headquarters. And that, I think, just complicates the withdrawal process from Vietnam, is because you have such a contentious relationship between McAfee and the White House that that strategy of withdrawing from Vietnam as a matter of purpose, in many instances, is undermined because of this poor relationship between these two critical personalities in the war.
Well, you get to the end, and what I, again, appreciate about what you've done here is you make the strongest case I've seen in a book that is, or two books that are focused on the American perspective of the war. Mm-hmm. Strong case for Vietnamese agency in its outcome. And then no matter what the United States did militarily, the war's outcome resides with the Vietnamese conduct of the war. Mm-hmm. You've spoken about this already. I think it's valuable. Not merely in a historical context, but I think also as an educational context, as we look at how we can take these case studies that you developed, and as you mm-hmm. say, look at current policy, look at current initiatives, and even future ones. What would you suggest would be the biggest takeaway for readers of Westmoreland's War and Withdrawal as they look beyond Vietnam?
I think it's, as I mentioned earlier, that there are limits to what we can accomplish. And to me, the value of rethinking about Westmoreland's strategy in particular is the narrative that is encouraging to policymakers is that Westmoreland had a single focus, which was attrition. When Abrams takes over, he turns the war around because he has a more comprehensive approach, places the Allies on the precipice of victory, and then it's the civilian policymakers that pull the rug out from not just the American military command, but from the Saigon leadership and the South Vietnamese population as a whole. That narrative, I think, is not only problematic, but potentially dangerous, because it tells this story of this savior general coming in and with a new strategy and a new thought process can turn around a war almost immediately. However, if we look at Westmoreland's strategy as something much more comprehensive than just attrition and see that it still came up short, that tells a very different story, I think, and a much more important story. That what if Westmoreland approached Vietnam more holistically than is the standard narrative? What if he felt, or what if he included political, economic development issues into his strategy, as well as trying to destroy the enemy, and still fail to accomplish his political objectives? That tells a very different story, I think, for current day policymakers. And if we continue that story, where a new commander comes in and tries to make adjustments, we can say that maybe Abrams emphasized things slightly differently than Westmoreland did, and still was only able to achieve a stalemate, then that should tell us something about the limits of American power abroad and the assumptions we make about military power offering us political objectives in a rather easy fashion. And so, to me, that's the value of gaining some perspective from this conflict, is if we take a more objective approach to American strategy and think about it as one that is not as narrow-minded and wrong-headed as some previous historians have suggested, then that tells us, I think, a very different story, I think, that is potentially more useful to us when it comes to our study of Vietnam.
That's a good way to go out.
Okay.
Well, it's time for our last questions. These have little to do with the books we've been talking about. First, Greg, what are you reading or viewing or consuming these days that you find really interesting?
To me, I think what I'm reading right now is works that are related to what I'm teaching this semester, which is a graduate course on war myth and memory, which I've just been really excited about putting together and teaching. And so what we're doing is kind of taking as much as we can, a holistic approach to how societies not only remember war, but turn war into certain myths and how war can become, in a sense, politically useful. And so I'm reading just some wonderful works. We're using David Blight's Race and Reunion on Civil War memory, which obviously has been in the news lately. We've got some great works we're going to be tackling on how Americans and Germans and Japanese all remembered the Second World War differently. Exactly. One of them. And as an example, the complicated post-war memory in Germany of the Second World War, I think is fascinating for students to tackle. We're taking a look at the My Lai massacre from the Vietnamese perspective, not from the American perspective, and how it's remembered there. So it should be an exciting course in terms of seeing how history is used and often misused to construct certain collective memories in societies and certain myths that are oftentimes socially or politically useful.
I'll be looking online to get your syllabus. I want to check that reading list out. The second question that is what's next on your slate?
I think I've said all I can say about American strategy. So I don't think I've got anything left in the tank when it comes to that. So, what I'm looking at, now is, more of a social and cultural study of the 1950s and 1960s, in terms of masculinity, and its relationship with the armed forces, through the specific lens of men's adventure magazines in the 1950s and 60s, and how the construction of military masculinity is portrayed in these magazines, how relationships between men and often soldiers or veterans, relations between men and women. And often I think what you find in these magazines too is a strain of sexual violence that what I'm hoping to explore is the narrative space that is opened up in these magazines that might be replicated in Vietnam.
Well, I mean, I envy you in that, but I would love to work on a project like that myself. But by the time I get there, it's going to be all gone. Very little of it will be left for me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation. I really did.
I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Greg, sounds good.
Good luck on everything going forward. And for our listeners, this is your host, Bob Wintermute, signing off for New Books in Military History. Thank you for listening.